Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. The Wilderness Act was signed into law by President Lyndon B. Johnson on September 3, 1964, after over 60 drafts and 8 years of work. It is remarkable for its succinct and poetic language. Quote, "In wilderness, in contrast with those areas where man and his works dominate the landscape, is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain." Across 51 years since the law's passage, the concept of wilderness has posed a challenge to our culture's utilitarian concept of land, leading to discussions, pitched political battles, and yes, active collaboration in selecting lands for congressional designation. John Gatchell knows a lot about that story. For 30 years, he's worked for the Montana Wilderness Association. John, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you, Brian.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in Detroit, near 8 Mile. And my father had a small engineering business there. And we grew up, we played baseball, hockey, rode our bikes across 16 lanes of traffic to spend Saturdays at a vacant lot catching frogs. And
catching frogs in Detroit.
Well, little nooks and crannies that were still left, pretty much.
How about your mom?
My mom was born and raised in Detroit as well. And she was the world's best mom. And I had three sisters.
What led to your interest in wildlife coming from Detroit, or wilderness, or wild land?
Well, my introduction to wild places for a city kid came through my grandfather, who was lived in North Ontario and was a trapper, prospector, poet, and most importantly for a 10-year-old kid, had a fishing lodge on a remote chain of lakes. So that was heaven for my cousins and I, was to spend as much time as possible with my grandfather camping and fishing.
How often would you get up there?
Got that every summer, pretty much.
Your mom's dad, your dad's dad?
My dad's dad, yeah.
How'd you end up in Montana?
I continued to go up to my grandfather's, and as a teenager traveled, the first time I traveled west was packing up my tent and hitchhiking across Canada to Alberta and BC, and I actually walked in from Waterton the first time I set foot in Montana to goat hunt, and thought it was one of the most beautiful places I'd ever seen on earth.
Did you say goat hunt?
Goat hunt.
Oh, that's a town?
Yeah, well, no, it's just a campsite on the south end of Waterton Lake in the middle of Glacier Park.
Funny, we don't think much of hitchhiking anymore. That takes back a ways. Now, that would have been about when?
That was around 1970. 71.
And you would have been how old?
18, 19.
So the Wilderness Act passed when you were about 10 or 11, something like that. Mm-hmm. When did you hear about it? When did it enter your consciousness?
I worked and saved my money so I could return to Montana, and then stayed in Montana, backpacked in the Missions and Glacier. And I think the first time I ever heard anything about wilderness was when I was working on a small ranch in the Bitterroot. There was some controversy involving Sapphire Mountains that my neighbors were involved with.
That would have been when?
That was about 1974.
Okay. So you came to Montana and stayed here and worked?
Yeah, I worked at a variety of jobs. I worked in the Bitterroot and then moved to the Swan and went to work logging and building log homes for a man named Henry Meyer. And started to explore the Swan Range, lived up near Salmon Prairie, and worked in the woods with Henry, and we built log houses. He had a small sawmill.
How did that experience strike you coming from an urban background? That's a pretty rural lifestyle.
I was great. I liked working with my hands. I learned a lot working in the woods with Walt Styler and Henry and the crew. And I had a chance, when I wasn't working, I'd be basically up in the Swan Range exploring wild places that were amazing to me.
Skipped your education, high school, college?
High school, and I never went to college. I took some classes at Flathead Valley Community College in subsequent years, but never earned a degree.
You're living in a landscape now with a group of people that some would say could not be more dramatically different than where you grew up. True, false, what were your impressions? What struck you? What was meaningful in those early years?
True differences, but also working people, and Detroit was definitely a place for working people. So there's a similarity. It's just there was no wild country like that left in Michigan. So Montana opened my horizons, I guess. And
so what did the wild country mean to you? Some people might be afraid of it, full of wild, dangerous animals.
You know, it was just amazing to spend time in wild places like Lion Creek and Pony Creek, Cat, Dog, and the Swan Range. And the Forest Service at that time started a process of evaluating areas that ought to be protected that were wild. So that led me to become involved, because the Swan Range seemed like a natural for a wilderness. Even though, you know, I worked with people in the, you know, we worked in the woods, but I think most people recognized that there was a right place for each thing.
Then now you're talking about people who lived on the land, mm-hmm. in the land, would say at that time, some of this ought to be set aside.
Yeah. That's right. And in the Swan Valley, there was a reaction, I think, against, especially by the old-timers and the hunters and people, against the pace of road building that was occurring in the 1970s. They were building roads as fast as they could.
And this was in the National Forest to get out the cut?
Yes, and also Plum Creek had interlocking lands.
Huh.
So the combination of the two to an area that pretty much had no roads in the early 1950s was transforming the Swan, and there was definitely a response locally of people who felt that roads shouldn't be built into every drainage in the Swan.
Give me an example of a seasoned person up from that country who felt there was had concerns about new roads in certain areas.
I wrote an article about Lion Creek and got a handwritten letter from a man named Bud Moore from Condon, who said we
interviewed Bud when he was 87.
Well, Bud wrote me a letter, and I still have that letter, that said, John, we should get together and talk about Lion Creek, because he agreed that it should stay wild. And eventually I worked with Bud, and he organized a community meeting in Condon in 1983, invited everybody from the community to talk about the forest planning process that the Forest Service was involved with. And out of that emerged a recommendation that the area remain wild, that found its way into the forest plan.
Now let's just stop a second. Forest plans are mandated by some federal law, and the forest has to plan ahead what it's going to do over a period of time, supposed to be reviewed every, 15 years, something like that?
In theory, yes.
In theory, and they, in theory, engage the public in that discussion before they make a decision, right?
That's right.
Just in case people don't remember Bud Moore, he was a remarkable guy, grew up in the Depression, didn't go to high school. It was too far, I think, from Lolo to Missoula for him to go to high school. He knew some of the old mountain men. As a teenager, he ran an 80-mile trap line, having built 7 log cabins in the Locksaw Wilderness. Later, was a Marine, went in 2 first wave assaults on Japanese-held beaches, became a member of the Forest Service in that capacity. He wrote a book later, the reason I know this, interviewed him about a book called The Locksaw Story. They sprayed, I think it was for the spruce budworm, the land that he knew like few others, and unintentionally devastated it because the cascading effect of the pesticide on up the food chain. He learned from that, and when I interviewed him in a log cabin that he had built masterfully, lined with books. He had a high school education. He didn't ever go to high school. He read a lot, and he was a pioneer in ecosystem management, I think he called it. He was an extraordinary guy. So you knew Bud when?
I met Bud in the early 1980s over our mutual interest in the Wild Swan Range, and worked with Bud. As you related, I mean, Bud had he had a little sawmill. He was an active forester, trapper, hunter, and had a great feel for the importance of preserving wilderness.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with John Gatchell in the first of two programs about the history of wilderness. So let me see if I get this straight. Bud Moore calls a meeting. Local people come. In those days, you're not talking about second homeowners. You're talking about working people in the woods.
Right. Lots of people that worked in the woods. Whatever people did. It was at the Conan Community Hall.
Okay.
And he invited the Forest Service to come listen.
And so the result of that meeting is local people say certain land should be set aside for wilderness.
Yeah, and they felt that other land should be available for logging and that there should be a mix of uses. And those basically formed a set of recommendations to the Forest Service from the community.
And were you at that meeting?
Yeah, I was at that meeting.
Okay, what kind of meeting was it? People shouting at each other? People talking? How would you describe it?
People talked respectfully. Bud facilitated the meeting. There was a moment when the Forest Service, one of the planners interjected that they couldn't do something, and Bud had this kind of way of saying, well, let's see now, is that a rule or a reg? And he'd write down what the people wanted anyway. So he faithfully carried forward what people, you know, took turns speaking. They didn't stand up and say, we want a Swan Range wilderness. Actually, what we heard was drainage by drainage. You know, I don't think they should build roads any further up Lion Creek. I don't think they should put a road into Dog Creek.
These are people that knew the land.
Yep, very much so. And I think it was a great lesson in, you know, forest planning did not have to be a bureaucratic exercise. It actually could engage people and engage communities like that and gather the wisdom and the field knowledge of people like that.
You say it was an example of what could be. The implication is it wasn't always that way in forest planning. Is that fair?
That's fair, especially in the 1980s.
Speaking of it as not always being that way, I have a recollection, it's not precise, of the development and designation of the Scapegoat Wilderness, where the process was pretty dramatically different. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's a fair assessment,
I
think.
Tell what happened.
What happened is that the Forest Service in that era was building roads as fast as they could into wild places. And one of the roads they wanted to build was right across the Continental Divide into what's now the Scapegoat Wilderness. And a store owner in Lincoln, Montana, named Cecil Garland, led the charge to organize local hunters to oppose that effort and eventually was successful in getting Congress to intervene and after 8 years pass and enact the Scapegoat Wilderness, which broke the mold because up until then, the agencies had controlled what lands would be considered for wilderness. And this frustrated the regional forester at the time, who said, you know, what business does a store owner in Lincoln, Montana, have drawing the boundaries for a wilderness? The Forest Service should do that. Well, the business was the business of democracy, and the example of Cecil Garland electrified people because all of a sudden, up until then, people felt like they were kind of trapped in a process, and now all of a sudden people realized they could take the bull by the horns and they could advocate and organize for the wild places that they felt should be protected, in our case, like the Swan Range.
My recollection, and correct me if I'm wrong, is in the case of the Scapegoat, the Forest Service was ready to move. A Republican congressman from eastern Montana called them, said he wanted some time to take a look at it, because I guess Cecil had written him a letter. The Forest Service basically told him to go fly a kite. They wouldn't give him a week to look at it. Is that exaggerated, or is that pretty much what happened?
Cecil had got on the phone and called every congressman and finally actually talked to Batten. Batten asked for 10 days. The regional forester said he didn't have 10 days. And
Batten being the congressman?
He was the a newly elected Eastern District Republican congressman from Eastern Montana.
So when the guys Forest Service said they didn't have 10 days...
He was mad, and he said, I better have 10 days, by golly. And eventually the congressman got his 10 days and looked into it, and he sent his staff out to look at it, and they reported back to him. And then he called Garland and said, well, you know, I need to know what you want. And he said, what do you mean? We want a wilderness area. He says, well, I need maps. So Cecil then tells a story about how he and a seasonal Forest Service employee drew the boundaries for the Scapegoat Wilderness that were introduced in the bill that Congressman Batten sponsored and eventually enacted.
So that sort of thing obviously would send tremors not only through the Forest Service, but through wilderness-interested people that the average person, if they knew what the hell they were talking about, could make a difference.
Exactly so.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with the Montana Wilderness Association's John Gatchell, who's been involved for more than 30 years in the struggle and battles and dialogues and collaborations that have achieved wilderness designations. So you have this example where there are people who took it to heart that actually made a difference.
There sure were. There were people like Bob Anderson from Livingston, Montana, that envisioned the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness that was eventually designated today, the 980,000-acre wilderness. There was Doris Milner, who was determined to see wilderness protected in the Selway Bitterroot. There was Arnie Boley in the Rattlesnake Wilderness in almost every case. And more recently, Gene Sense from Shoto, a school teacher from Shoto, who was really the person that drove what eventually became the Rocky Mountain Front Heritage Act. It's individuals like that that have made the difference in Montana wilderness over the years.
Okay, one might say individuals can articulate an idea, but if you're talking about getting something passed in Congress, you're talking about a pretty complicated process. So what happened between these people getting a vision, pick any one of those you want, and getting the kind of support necessary to get a wilderness designation through Congress? And where'd the support come from?
Well, the support came particularly, I think, in Montana from the hunting community, backcountry hunters, from backcountry outfitters. The support grew from there eventually to communities. And it took champions in the congressional delegation to move legislation. It took Pat Williams to see the Rattlesnake Wilderness and Recreation Area designated. It took Lee Metcalf to see the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness, which was actually passed shortly after his death, but it was his bill and his work that carried it forward. Senator Baucus championed the Rocky Mountain Front Heritage Act. In every case, it takes someone that moves it forward. Senator Tester is the one that actually got the Rocky Mountain Front Heritage Act passed. And without his willingness to make that happen, it would never have happened.
Now, going back to the Bud Moore meeting, when was that?
At the Condon Community Hall, that was 1983.
Okay. I came to Montana in 1989, and there had just been a multi-year battle over wilderness designation down in the Gallatin. That would not have fit my definition of collaboration. You had the timbering community in the form of Plum Creek and perhaps Brandes Lumber, I don't remember for sure, in what I would call a pitched political battle. So what's going on here? On collaboration on one hand, local people saying we want wilderness. On another hand, the industry saying no how, no way.
Well, in the 1980s, there was a period of 6 years when the congressional delegation was fashioning a Montana wilderness bill. They were going to make a decision about what areas should remain wild and what areas should be available for logging.
Now, you just said the Montana delegation was going to do it. That's different than local people, correct or not?
Well, that's right, but they were getting input. They had public hearings in Great Falls, Missoula, Livingston, and Kalispell, and they gathered input from people, and and eventually passed a bill in 1988 that was, after Congress adjourned, was never signed by the president. So it sent the Montana wilderness debate and the resolution of the conflict between timber and wilderness was all unresolved in 1989. The congressional delegation changed and divisions deepened. There were rallies by the timber industry, rallies by conservationists, more public hearings, and I think the divisions deepened, and there was this sense that people had to choose between jobs in the timber industry and wilderness. And in that sense, in 1990, the AFL-CIO was, which represented, among other, they represented seven millworker unions and paperworker unions in western Montana, challenged us at a meeting and said, well, if you're going to force us to choose between jobs and wilderness, we're going to choose jobs. And we didn't think that was necessary, and that led to discussions that eventually set the stage. We thought we'd try direct dialogue in Libby, Montana. At the time, there was a very large sawmill and a local lumber production industrial workers, and so our members in Libby met with the local workers and eventually, over a period of about 7 months, hammered out an agreement on timber and wilderness that covered the most productive forest in Montana, the Kootenai National Forest.
And this began in the 90s?
The first discussions were probably late 1989.
Okay, and when did they conclude with this agreement?
They signed the agreement in June 1990 at the Union Hall in Libby in a public signing ceremony, and it just rocked the state.
Now let's talk about this, rocked the state. You had a period that you described where there were disagreements, there was finally some agreement, it was not signed by the president, that was President Reagan.
That's right.
We had a divided congressional delegation, Republican and Democrat, and a period of increasing jobs versus wilderness debate, if I understand you,
exactly.
In the sense that that's how it was framed. My recollection of that was it was fairly partisan, one side in terms of at least elected officials, the Democrats being more inclined towards some wilderness and the Republicans less inclined. Is that a fair summary in a nutshell?
I think it became increasingly that way, yes.
Okay. So then you're saying a group of unions got together. These are logging timber unions.
Lumber production, industrial workers, the paper workers from Frenchtown at the time. There were seven unions and two different national forests. Eventually, we set up another set of discussions based in Bonner and Missoula with Western Montana timber workers, and that led to a second agreement, the Lolo Accord.
I don't remember timber unions, mill unions, as a major force. Obviously, my memory is flawed, or I came in, I was here in the 90s, so that happened when I was here. You're saying trade unions were a force politically. You guys negotiated with them and came to agreement?
Yeah, and they were frustrated because they'd never been involved in it, and it affected their jobs. And they had this frustration. And so at the time, the unions felt that they could play a role in brokering an agreement that would help resolve and move the issue forward, that would both help sustain their jobs and would result in designated wilderness that didn't conflict with timber jobs.
Now, you had become a staff member of the Montana Wilderness Association when?
1985.
And were you involved in these discussions personally?
I was involved with the discussions, particularly I facilitated the conservation side of the negotiations on the Lolo Accord. And worked with our members in Libby. The discussions in Libby were all local.
How did those discussions compare going back to Bud Moore's? You're not dealing with local people, you're dealing with union people concerned about their mill jobs. Similarities, differences?
I think some differences in that mill workers weren't necessarily as knowledgeable as people that worked in the woods. Some were and some weren't. Some were avid hunters. Those things came out later. They brought in forestry consultants when they felt they needed to make sure that they understood what they were negotiating. And I think the similarity is that the issues of jobs and wilderness on different parts of the landscape could be sorted out by people that were trying to sort out those differences, to come up with creative solutions. And the lesson for us was that we actually, the timber workers ended up supporting significantly more wilderness than the congressional delegation had been willing to support, because it was not in conflict with their work. Hmm. And they saw value because they lived there and they hunted in these places. And as the one mill worker in Thompson Falls said, we got to save something for our kids.
Two questions. What was the Forest Service's role in those discussions, going back to the idea that they used to say, we'll call the shots, we're the pros?
Well, the Forest Service's role in this case was limited to information, which they were very helpful with. So we used information from the Forest Service to, where was their timber, where
they
was
were not. Advisory.
Advisory, right, strictly advisory.
The other thing you said that struck me was that your group, you timber worker unions and wilderness advocates, came up with more wilderness designation recommendations than the congressional delegation staffs. What's your explanation for that?
First of all, the conflicts between timber and wilderness were actually quite small. And secondly, I think local people had a greater interest in not only in jobs, but also in preserving lands nearby their community where they could hunt and fish and camp and take their kids. And a great example of that would be the Cabinet Mountains, which is tremendous wild country, but half of it's unprotected. So we had a much better proposal for protecting the remainder of the Cabinet Mountains than the Forest Service's proposal.
And in a nutshell, because we're running out of time in this program, and as I want to remind the listeners, we're going to do a second one with John on this subject, what happened to those agreements in Congress?
They were introduced as a separate bill, S-72, by Senator Baucus. Hearings were held in Libby and Missoula, and another set of hearings the following year. Eventually, a great deal of it, not all of it, went into a statewide bill that was passed in the U.S. Senate in 1992. A subsequent bill that was passed by the House in 92, but the House and Senate, for political reasons, never reconciled their differences, so no bill went to the president.
John Gatchel, I very much regret to say we're out of time, but I'm pleased to say we're going to continue this discussion next week.
All right, thank you, Brian.
To our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground, and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.